Blog Talk Radio.
This is the Horse Radio Network.
What a beautiful day for horses in the morning.
Well, good Tuesday morning, everybody. I am Glenn the Geek from Ocala, Florida.
And I'm Coach Jen from the Pasture View Studio in Ocala, and you're listening to the Horses in the Morning Show on the Horse Radio Network for September 17th, episode 746. Good morning, Horse World!
Good Tuesday morning to you, and I do mean a good Tuesday morning.
Well, if you insist on being accurate about it.
You know, only somebody with perfect comedic timing could produce this much energy in one shot.
Your time in the saddle ain't as rough as the life in between, and the fence isn't there for you to straddle, and you can't change horses in the middle of your dream.
Well, good morning, everybody, and thank you for joining us here at Horses in the Morning. We appreciate you stopping by for a little fun and entertainment this morning. We promise that we will not talk about poopy worms today. That was yesterday's topic, and if you missed it, you can go back and take a listen to that. And I'm surprised, actually, we didn't get any comments about that on Facebook. Apparently, our listeners didn't think that was as gross as Jamie and I did. But Jennifer, thank you for joining me today as co-host. And I got to tell everybody, just to let you know, it's 98 days till Christmas.
Good to know. Today. Very good to
isn't
know.
Isn't it just weird to say 98 days till Christmas? It's like almost October already.
We still have Halloween and Thanksgiving to get through. I don't want to be talking about Christmas.
Well, you know, the reason I thought of that is when I was at Walmart on Sunday doing some grocery shopping, the Christmas aisles are already starting to fill up. Believe it or not, there was one aisle with Christmas stuff in it already, right beside the Halloween aisle. Yep.
So are they even going to have a Thanksgiving aisle?
No. We're just going to go right from Halloween to Christmas, it looks like.
You know what that is? That's smart thinking on their part. That's all the leftover Christmas stuff from last year that they put back up to regular price.
That's true. And they had an extra aisle. Apparently, they didn't have enough Halloween stuff. So we have an aisle. What are we going to do with it? I noticed there's two complete aisles right down from the Christmas and Halloween stuff that have nothing but totes. And they have, like, one tote in each pile lined up along the things, which tells me that they had nothing to put in those aisles. There's that in-between time. So.
The tote shipment is stuck in a boat on its way back from China right now.
Funny. So, Jennifer, we have a fun show planned for today. Tell us about it.
On today's Totally Tuesday edition, we go west, young man and lady, west. Our first stop is Santa Anita Park in California, where the fall meet is about to begin and will culminate in November with the Breeders' Cup Series, and our tour guide will be Caton Bradar. And heading west again, and then west some more, and then west a little bit more right across the international date line, and providing Skype gods are smiling, the Mongol Derby winner Lara Pryor Palmer should be stopping by to recount her adventure, winning the longest horse race in the world. I can't wait for that. And for fun and giggles, while we travel between destinations, we have some cowhand trivia, crazy headlines, and distinctly dubious lists. And wrapping it all up in a neat little bow, happy Constitution Day, everyone. On this day in 1787, 38 of the 41 delegates available signed the Constitution of the United States. And no, that is not when it became effective. That took another 18 months.
Wow. Okay, good. Thank you, Jennifer. You know, Lara Pryor Palmer, we're hoping to get her on today. But as Jennifer said, we're kind of relying on the Skype gods. It sometimes works from England, and sometimes it doesn't. So we hope that she'll join us because she has an amazing story. Now, let's to start out, let's do our daily winnings. Well, my daily Winnie goes to Charlie, the tiny pony who stands just 25 inches tall, who travels all around Italy performing with his master and doing expos and shows, and Bartolo Messina, his owner, says he's an equestrian artist, and I don't know exactly what he does at the shows, but apparently it was enough to cause him to get enough attention that somebody broke into his stall at the National Horse Fair and stole him. Yep, he was in his stall in the evening after he did his show at the 47th edition of the National Horse Fair, and his owner went out the next morning and he was gone. Apparently the thieves had cut the wire fences around the fairgrounds, and I love how the story says the thieves were purloined the pony, simply cut their way through the protective wires. That doesn't sound good. Purloined the pony. You know, it sounds like you put him on a spit. Cut their way through the protective wires, guarding the fairgrounds, retrieved the pony, and made a way to their rendezvous spot where a vehicle awaited them for the getaway. This is going to be a freaking movie. I mean, it's going to be a movie. Now, what caught my headlines and what's been all over the press the last 2 days, and mainstream press alike, is that they think, the police think, that the Tony was abducted by the Italian mafia and that eventually they'll get a ransom demand for the little pony. Yeah.
Now, we need to snope this thing or something because, honestly, it sounds like the plot line for a new Disney movie starring some... It's like the Apple Dumpling Gang. That's what just makes me think of.
Yes, it is kind of Apple Dumpling Gang. It kind of reminds me of Home Alone. And you're going to see, and the crooks here are going to be the two bumbling idiot guys. And we're all just waiting to see the new Home Alone movie come out. And it's going to be about Charlie the Pony getting abducted for ransom. Now, the thing that struck me about this is, do you think the mafia would, is there nobody or nothing else in Italy they could abduct for ransom that's going to bring them more money than Charlie the Pony? How much are you going to pay?
Well, maybe they went with Charlie the Pony not because of the cash value, but because of the press value. Who cares if some politician gets kidnapped? Really? There's going to be a lot of people that are going, yay, kidnap the politician. Nobody wants to see a pony kidnapped. That's universal. Maybe that's the route they're going. They're going to play the sympathy card.
The first thing I thought of is I hope Charlie the Pony doesn't end up like the horse did in what was the mafia movie? The Godfather. So that was my first thought, and maybe that's because I watched The Godfather, and that always, the horse head scene always stuck with me. So let's hope Charlie is put up for ransom. That doesn't happen. But yeah, I mean, like nothing better to abduct in Italy right now. The mafia must be bored.
Yeah, but the business is slow.
Business is slow in Italy. Jeez.
The economic downturn has taken its toll.
What, nobody using drugs anymore? God. Anyway, your turn.
Oh, God. In keeping with our Western theme Tuesday, my daily Winnie goes out to Elisa Wallace, her fiancé Tim, and her dad Rick, who are collectively known as Team Wallace. They are on their way and or in Fort Worth, Texas, to compete at the Mustang Million Extreme Mustang Makeover event. And what put Team Wallace over the top into Daily Winnie territory is Rick Dad Wallace, who is also an eventer, an avid competitor, just recently returned from a horse trials and promptly broke his wrist, and I will quote a friend who posted on his Facebook, snapped it in half.
Ooh.
Yeah. Got it all patched back together and hopped onto his favorite mode of transport and is on his way to Fort Worth, Texas, sans painkillers, to support his daughter, who is competing in Texas at the Mustang Million. So go Team Wallace.
So is this not now like the, by the way, that just shows you he's a horse person and an eventer, right? That
he's
nothing
eventer,
slows
yeah.
them down. Yeah. Now, is this the finals? They're going down there to compete to see who wins now? Is that what's going on?
Yes. They've had all of the qualifying Mustang Millions all over the United States all year long. And money is in Fort Worth, and it starts, I think it started officially yesterday, was check-in, and it runs through the weekend. So if you're anywhere near Fort Worth, it's worth going to. And there are a couple of hundred.
I think Jennifer just got cut off here, actually. So I will we'll try and get her back on here shortly. And in the meantime, while we're waiting for her to get back, we will I have a news story here for you. Let me get to it. There was an interesting article in thehorse.com that was about mules, horses, and donkeys. And what this was a study done by British scientists. And it was about spatial recognition, spatial cognition, which means that it's the, you know, it is basically the capacity to figure out where things are and to navigate around objects and to find where a gate is in a field, let's say. Well, they did this study to see who was brighter, whether it was mules, donkeys, or horses. And for all of you horse lovers out there, I got to tell you, they didn't do so well in the spatial cognition test. According to research, mules appear to have a faster capacity to learn about spatial relations, figuring out where things are, or navigating around objects than horses or donkeys. And when objects get moved, the animals must find new paths around them. Horses stand out as being particularly attached to their old ways. In other words, they tend to stubbornly insist that the old way is the right way and that it still must be the way it was before. So, yep, horses are as stubborn as mules. I found this very interesting. The cognitive task started with a simple design of setting up a fence between an animal and its food with an open gate at one end of the fence. The research tested 12 horses, 12 donkeys, and 12 mules as they each find their way to the fuel, to the food. While horses usually worked at a trot, donkeys worked at a slow walk and mules at a fast walk. It was the mule who would find the open gate the fastest. The horses were the slowest to solve the problem, even though they were usually at a trot. Now, they complicated things by rearranging where the gates were to continue the testing, and mules were slightly better at finding the new gate than donkeys were, but for the most part, it was a 50-50 chance of them finding the gate, which I thought was interesting. The horses, on the other hand, kept insisting that the gate was still at the same place, and they refused to believe their eyes. So they just stood at the gate where it used to be and wouldn't move. Now, they do say that the mule's advanced intelligence gives them the ability to make decisions based on logic and safety, but that has often been as misunderstood as stubbornness. But that expression, stubborn as a mule, would be better described as sensible as a mule. Now, they do say that there's a reason mules are not used for riding a lot of times is because that mules do have this sense of self-preservation and really wanting to preserve themselves and protect themselves. So that's why they were never used. If you think about all the battle scenes in the movies and the cavalry and things, you never see mules in those battle scenes. It's always the horses. And that's because the mules have this self-preservation thing that they just would be so stubborn they wouldn't do it. And that's why they were used to pull the wagons and the ammunition and things like that in the background, because they were too smart to want to get shot at. It's basically what it comes down to.
There you go.
The horses, on the other hand, were like, yeah, shoot me, I don't care, let's go.
I like this, though, because now you can't say, I'm stubborn, I'm sensible.
That's right. You're not stubborn as a mule anymore. You're sensible. That's right. You are redeemed, Jennifer, because I have accused you of being stubborn at times. There's been a time or two when stubbornness has been on your plate.
I'm not stubborn. I'm sensible.
That's right. Well, why don't you try and get our first guest on here? And I have another news story I can do in the meantime.
Not going to be easy.
Hopefully you won't get cut off again. Now, I did want to mention that, you know, we talked about yesterday about the prices of horses that are going at the Keeneland sales right now. And we have the fall sale going on down there, which is their biggest sale. And we'd already sold $200 million worth of horses halfway through the sale. Well, it's not going so well in the with the thoroughbreds up in Canada. Apparently, the government had canceled a $345 million share of slot machine revenues that went to the tracks and took it away from the horse racing industry. So what's happened is the horse racing industry up there is basically tanked in the meantime. They had an auction at Flamborough Downs, which is in Ontario, and they had a horse auction like they usually do every year, and the prices were a quarter or less to what they were last year. So horses that were selling for $30,000, $40,000 last year were selling for $5,000 this year. Apparently, a lot of breeders and trainers lost a lot of money in this auction, and they're all waiting to see what's going to happen. There has been a board that has been asked that's been established, the Horse Racing Transition Board, to come up with a comprehensive five-year plan to help this transition from dumping the $345 million. And basically, they got no warning. The government just did it, and they got no warning that this was going to happen. This board has been asked to decide on the distribution of the minimum of 800 racing days, support for the breeders, a revised governance structure, integrating horse racing with gaming in Ontario, and a specific amount of government investment to achieve vibrant, substantial horse racing industry. Well, you know, the big problem was here that nobody got a warning, and basically everybody is taking a beating up there right now in the racing industry. So we'll keep an eye on that story for you, and we wish the best for everybody involved in racing up there in Canada. So as good as things seem to be going at the auctions down here, they're not going as well in Canada. And on the racing front, and we're going to be talking about racing in just a minute, hopefully if Jennifer can get our guest on the line here, if she can get Caitlin Brader from HRTV. She's been on with us before. She's going to talk a little bit about the opening meet at St. Anita. But Australia yesterday, the Australian Racing Board announced a complete ban on the use of steroids, both in and out of competition. Foremost, the board's consideration was the need for absolute integrity and public confidence in racing. So the ban covering all horses 6 months or older takes effect May 1st, and they basically will ban all types of steroids. Most racing jurisdictions around the world do limit steroids, and they have decided to go that route as well. So Australia is getting on board with the ban, and we'll see how that goes and what kind of uproar that brings in Australia with the racing community. So we will be keeping an eye on that as well. And it does look like Jennifer is having a little bit of a trouble getting on this morning. We're having a little bit of trouble with our phone lines today. I'm glad it's not tomorrow. Let me mention that as well, that it is going to be the EquityMFG.com Wheel of Trivia back tomorrow. So we didn't have it last week because we were off for 9/11, but we are back here. Jamie will be back, and we're going to do the Wheel of Trivia tomorrow. So you want to give us a call at 9:05 a.m. at 347-637-3238 and be put in the lineup. And we can get you on and hopefully answer a trivia question correctly and win one of hundreds of dollars surprises on the wheel. There's a lot of stuff on there right now, so you'll definitely want to tune in. Well, while we're waiting for our first guest, let's take a break for our first commercial, and we'll be back, hopefully, with Caitlin in just a second. Hi, Glenn here from the Horse Radio Network, and I am with Debbie at Equestrian Collections with this week's Product of the Week.
This week, I am featuring a Professional's Choice Combo Bandage, which is really sort of a polo wrap type. But the reason I picked this is because this particular bandage is sort of unique. The inside of it, the part that goes against the horse's leg, is that same soft, fleecy polo type of material. But the outside is a stretchy non-fuzzy material. So when you wrap the horse's leg, and always remember that wrapping polos and stuff is a very careful. You have to be very careful with how you do that because you can damage your horse if you don't. If you don't know how to do it, be sure and get some instructions on how to. But when you use this bandage, it looks neat and clean on the outside and doesn't have the fuzzies to pick up everything in the world that's out there, especially in the fall when things are blowing around. But the inside is still the soft fuzzy part that's very soft against the horse's leg. So I featured this because it's different from your regular polo bandage. It comes in white and black, very conducive, particularly to dressage people because of the colors and stuff. And it's only $35.95. Now, that's a bit pricey for a regular polo, but it's an excellent price for this combo bandage. I think if you get one, you will feel you'll be very happy with it because it's very comfortable for the horse and looks very neat when you're using it.
It has a professional's choice quality as well. So take a look at equestriancollections.com and search Professional's Choice Combo Bandage, and you'll find them in black and white.
Well, thank you to Equestrian Collections for their continuing support of Horses in the Morning. You can also follow them on Facebook at Equestrian Collections. Just do a search for that. They post lots of good stuff over there, including our shows. So we really like them for that as well. Well, we have Caitlin on right now from HRTV. Good morning, Caitlin.
Good morning.
So good to have you back. And we're going to have a little fun this morning talking about Santa Anita. Now, for all of our listeners around the world, which we have many, and for all the ones on the East Coast that have never been out there, tell us a little bit about Santa Anita and the racetrack out there.
Well, you know, Santa Anita is for years known as the Great Race Place because it's one of the older racetracks in the country and has always been kind of the racetrack that attracted the top horses, the top horsemen. And, of course, being in Southern California, it attracts the movie stars and the rich and famous. And so even though, you know, we might hear about Del Mar and that being started by Bing Crosby, there was just as much glamour surrounding Santa Anita really since its inception. And some of the best horses in the history of the sport have raced in California. Horses like Seabiscuit have been, you know, legends and made their mark at that track. And I think it's no coincidence that the Breeders' Cup, the biggest event we have in horse racing now, returns there frequently. This will be the second straight year that we'll be at Santa Anita. And in fact, the following year, it'll be back again in 2014. So it will have its mark in Breeders' Cup history and racing history.
Now, the Santa Anita was opened in 1934, which is interesting because it was opened right around Depression time. And I always found that interesting that they were able to get it open during that period of time because it was a tough time in America.
Definitely. And, you know, interestingly, it was at one point it was stopped for racing and used as an internment camp during World War II as well. So, I mean, it's played a significant role in the landscape, not just for horse racing, but horse racing's actually survived some of the biggest disasters and landmarks in our country's history, too, but particularly at Santa Anita.
And it kind of has that Art Deco look. It's probably one of the few racetracks in the world that is in the Art Deco style.
It is. And it's actually, I believe, on a historical architecture and landmarks registry as well. So it's in some degrees a sort of a protected a piece of Americana, and particularly because of that architecture.
Now, you've been to a lot of racetracks, and we have as well. And I think you're going to know what I mean. When every racetrack has a feel. When you walk into it, you get a feeling. You know, some racetracks it's not a great feeling, and then some racetracks like Keeneland and places like that, Keeneland, and you end up at Saratoga. You know, you get a certain feel when you walk in. What's the feeling that you get at Santa Anita?
You are awestruck because beyond the landscape and beyond the feeling in the paddock of something important and something that's been there since the 1930s, it's very much the same in many ways. The feeling is historic. But the track is set with the backdrop of the San Gabriel Mountains. So it's one of the most majestic settings that you'll see at a racetrack. So when you walk out onto the racetrack apron, you know, maybe by Clocker's Corner, which is the area at the top of the home stretch where horsemen gather in the morning, but where fans gather as well, either to watch workouts or to watch the races. And you kind of just gaze out at this vast racetrack and the horses, and a lot of times in the morning it's cooler, so you can see their breath, and you see kind of a mist or fog coming off of the mountains. It's just incredible. It's one of the most beautiful settings you'll find for thoroughbred horse racing.
Now, you've been in racing for 20 years, or more than that, actually. You've been covering, as a journalist, and your family has been in racing. Is there a track, now that we're talking, I want to get into talking a little bit about horses, too, but before we get off the track, is there a track that's like a favorite that when you go, you consider it home? It's like your home. You walk in and you go, I'm at home here.
Well, you're very kind to give me only 20 years. I actually had the privilege of growing up around racing. And so, in a sense, whenever I go to any racetrack, there's a comfort level or a feeling of that, even some of the ones that aren't quite as aesthetically pleasing as a Santa Anita. But for me, Arlington Park will always be that track because even though it's very different than the way it was when I was a child, it's a brand-new grandstand, it was the first racetrack I ever went to. I went there with my parents. I grew up around that racetrack. And undoubtedly, there's not a time that I would walk through the gates and not find either someone in the crowd or someone in the trainer's ranks that I've known for a very long time. So that'll always be my home track. I met my husband there. I became engaged there. I saw the first Arlington Million. I saw most of the Arlington Million. So I've kind of grown up around that racetrack. So that is my home track. And not coincidentally, it's an incredibly beautiful racetrack. But it is sparkling and beautiful and kind of one of the places that people who love racing should get a chance to see. But what Santa Anita, for example, has, and a track like Saratoga as well that I was just at for the summer, is that sense of history. You walk through it and you feel that it looks very similar in many ways to the way it was when they first started racing in the 30s or 40s, and for Saratoga even longer. But it you just have that sense of stepping back a little bit in history and seeing maybe a slice of life as to how it was then, too. So they preserved that feeling, that tradition, which is something I absolutely love.
So for this year's fall meet, now, because does Santa Anita also have a spring meet or just in the fall?
Well, actually, Santa Anita will have a different meet this year because in the past, their calendar, they've kind of turned the reins over, so to speak, to the Oak Tree Racing Association, and Oak Tree held a separate kind of self-contained meeting at Santa Anita, and now that all is going to change, or is changing, and going forward, they run around the Breeders' Cup, but then what's kind of the tradition is that the racing kicks off again. Kind of once we get through the Breeders' Cup, there used to be a little break, and there will be for Hollywood Park, and then they get started again on December 25th or 26th, I believe, the day after Christmas has for years been kind of their spot on the calendar to kick things off, and then they run through the winter and toward the spring. But the calendar is going to change dramatically next year because of the absence or the loss of Hollywood Park. This will be their last season. So I'm not exactly sure what going forward the calendar is going to be like for Santa Anita. It's certainly going to be one of the major racing locations throughout the year in Southern California, in California in general, and on the West Coast. But for right now, they run, and they have for years, you'll see racing at Santa Anita in the fall and then over the course of the winter.
Is the Great Footing debacle still raising its ugly head, or has that settled down to a dull roar?
Oh, That's all gone for Santa Anita's purposes. They've gone back to a traditional dirt track, and that's what's worked best for them. So the Breeders' Cup last year, as well as this year, will be contested on what's considered a traditional or a very, I think, neutral dirt track Plus, you have their magnificent turf course, which is a down-the-hill course, by the way. Not the entire course, but for some of the races, you start kind of in an offshoot that goes way, way, way up a hill, and you really can't appreciate it unless you get a chance to ride up it. But it is quite a slope that the horses break out of the starting gate and run down the hill around a slight bend back onto the main course. And some of them love it, and some of them just don't feel quite as secure running downhill as they do across the flat. So
most of them have never seen a hill before.
Well, exactly. But, you know, the ones that like it, you can just see it as they go over it. They look so excited. They're like children that, you know, are getting to run down the hill and having a blast in the time of their lives. So so we kind of look for those specialists, the down-the-hill specialists. And this is, in at least in North America, the only place I know of that has that type of a course. So it's very unique.
Yes, certainly. Put a brush jump or two, and you'll have a race, right?
Exactly.
Do they ever have jump races at Santa Anita?
You know, I don't. That's a good question. They have it recently, and I don't know if they used to at any point in time. But no, and it would be kind of a fun thing to watch.
Let's talk a little bit about horses. You know, we've been covering Wise Dan here and following Wise Dan pretty closely. My co-host, Jamie's not here this morning, is a big Wise Dan fan. And we talked a little bit about the race over the weekend and, you know, how he did over the Woodbine Mile over the weekend, setting a record time. And, you know, did it pretty handily. The jockey didn't even get his whip out. So, you know, now I saw an article this morning that he's drawing closer to Game On Dude in the latest poll for Horse of the Year. What do you think?
You know, it's a fascinating. It's going to come down to the Breeders' Cup again in many, many ways, because Wise Dan is exceptional in that he's been able to make his mark primarily on the grass without winning on at the Grade One level on the dirt. That's very rare that we see a horse voted Horse of the Year as we did last year. I voted for him. I think he deserved it. I think almost most of my colleagues would agree with that. That it shouldn't be limited in terms of what surface the horse runs over to determine who should be Horse of the Year. But this year we've had some awfully good performances as well, particularly by Game On Dude. Now, what's interesting about Game On Dude is that last year he came into the Breeders' Cup in very good form and kind of bombed in the Breeders' Cup. And he sort of is looking to make amends, and he bombed this in the head. They had trouble previously in Dubai, so this year a very different campaign for him to get him to the Breeders' Cup and to get him to Santa Anita, and many would argue he's a stronger, better horse this year. If Game On Dude continues to run the way he is and wins the Breeders' Cup Classic, I think it will be very hard for voters to not make him Horse of the Year. But that's a big if. He has to do it. In the meantime, Wise Dan, if he comes back and continues to run the way he's done, and I think Charlie Lopresti's talking about running him possibly, maybe once between now and the Breeders' Cup. It depends on how he comes out of the Woodbine race. So if he's to win at Keeneland and then he comes back and wins what's likely to be an international against an international field in the Breeders' Cup Turf Mile, then he makes a very good case for himself, and it's going to require Game On Dude to win and win, I think, pretty impressively in the Classic to take it away from him. But it's kind of what I think the people who originated and came up with the concept of the Breeders' Cup dreamed about. You know, a scenario where you have horses coming back 1 year to the next and putting in campaigns geared toward the Breeders' Cup so that fans could start watching them early on and following their horses and picking their favorites and then developing kind of these followings as well as this these incredible horses on the racetrack that then would have a chance to, you know, kind of cement the title one way or the other. And, you know, we haven't even talked about Royal Delta, who has been incredible this year. And if she wins in the Breeders' Cup, it's back to the distaff. It was the ladies' classic for a couple of years, and now we're back to the distaff. It would be the third straight year that she won the race, and that's unprecedented. If she wins and then the others bomb, perhaps she makes a case for herself or even in the voters, although that's even more exceptional for a filly, a girl, to get the vote over the boys.
Right, right. What do you see for the Breeders' Cup this year? Is it is there excitement? I wanted to ask you that, too, in general. You know, we talked about the racetracks, how certain ones you walk in have certain feels. How does this year feel? We have record. We're going to be setting we're going to be way over last year at the Keeneland sales. Does it feel like racing is back? Did you get that feeling in the barns?
Oh, definitely. I think that everyone is excited and optimistic. And, you know, when you see, you know, it all starts with the economy. I think racing mirrors the world at large very much so. So when there's anxiety and stress, or when there are economic hardships, that comes through in the racing and in the racing world, the sale world too. And so we had our tough years, but this year in particular, the weather has been better than I ever remember it, which is a real big factor in whether people come out to the races, whether fields stay large, and whether meets can be deemed successful. So we've had kind of unprecedented good weather all season long. We've had more of the horses that we saw last year as sort of the heroes and the stars come back and hold their form this year. We've seen great indicators at the sales. So definitely people are really excited. They're enthused. They're pumped up. There's always a lot of anticipation for the Breeders' Cup, but I think this year maybe a little bit more so than ever, because we do have Wise Dan and we do have Royal Delta, and we actually have Groupie Doll, who won the Filly and Mare Sprint and was the Filly and Mare Sprint champion last year. She just won at Parks last year, and, you know, she looks like she's getting back to her old self. And really, I was looking, and there are as many as 9 winners from last year that are still in training this year. That's huge. I can't remember another time when we've seen 9
wow.
U.S. horses that won Breeders' Cup races that are still in training. Now, some of them, they still have a little ways to go to end up back in the Breeders' Cup, but if that were to happen, that's just amazing. So there's tremendous excitement and anticipation at this point. You won't kind of feel it until Santa Anita gets running, and then also when the horses start shipping in from the East Coast, that's when it really gets exciting.
And now, how about HRTV? I assume you guys are going to be there all the way up until the Breeders' Cup?
Oh, yeah, for sure. And, you know, we will have, obviously, complete coverage of the Santa Anita meet, but also of the Breeders' Cup itself. We've already started our coverage, which is on Thursday nights and Sunday nights. Pursuit of the Cup airs weekly and tracks kind of on Thursday what's going on in all the Breeders' Cup races. Jeff Siegel has a countdown with his top horses in each category. And then on Sundays, we kind of recap the stakes action that's relevant to the Breeders' Cup. So the coverage has already started and in full force. And I'll be at Belmont Park on the 28th of September for the Jockey Club Gold Cup, which is kind of a precursor, stepping stone to the Breeders' Cup Classic. We're hoping we get a chance to see Orb, the Kentucky Derby winner, take on his elders in that one. So that'll be really exciting. And, of course, HRTV will have daily coverage from start to finish from Santa Anita as well when the meet kicks off and leading up to and through the Breeders' Cup. Once we start that, we actually begin our coverage even earlier in the morning and have the workouts and reaction on Pursuit of the Cup. And I believe we have West Rock Coffee's first call daily that week of Breeders' Cup through the weekend. So just a busy time for us, for sure, but exciting.
Well, and if you live in an area where you can't get HRTV like we do, we're in the horse capital down here in, believe it or not, in Ocala, and we can't get HRTV. So if you live in an area where you can't, you can still catch it online. Go to HRTV.com. And Kate and Brader, thank you so much for joining us. You're always a terrific guest, and we appreciate you getting up early to chat with us.
Oh, thank you so much. It's great to talk with you guys, and look forward to seeing more or talking more with you as we get closer to the Breeders' Cup.
Sounds terrific. Thanks, Kate.
Bye.
Well, that was Kate and Brader. She is of HRTV, and we appreciate HRTV. We've been working with them for the 2 years now since we've had the Horses in the Morning show, and they've been great to work with, and we appreciate all their help in lining up guests to talk a little bit about racing. And I know Jamie's probably upset she couldn't be here today for that one. Well, we're trying to get Laura Pryor-Palmer on, winner of the Mongol Derby. She's in England having a little trouble calling into her system, and we can't call out to her, unfortunately. So we're going to keep working on that. Jennifer's working on it now. And in the meantime, Let's take a break for our song of the day, and this is one of Jennifer's favorites. It's called Endless Sky by Kristen Harris. And we'll be right back after this, hopefully with our next guest. That was Kristen Harris. You can find all of her music at kristenharris.com. And we'll put a link to that in our show notes as well. You're listening to Horses in the Morning. I am here with Coach Jen. Jamie has a day off today. She will be back tomorrow. And we are brought to you today by Equestrian Collections. We'll be playing the EquityMFG.com Wheel of Trivia tomorrow, so you want to be sure to join us then. Well, Laura Pryor-Palmer is trying to call us, but it's not working very well on Skype from England, so we may end up having to, what do you think, Jennifer? We may end up having to record the interview and play it another day when we can actually do it outside of our system here in the morning show. Oh, you must be on mute. I think you're on mute.
Well, I am on mute. Look at me. that's so everybody doesn't hear me typing furiously to Lara in England. It looks like we might end up going that route because she's not having any luck getting Skype to cooperate because Skype is sensible. Skype is sensible. Yes.
It's not stubborn as a mule.
No, it's sensible.
Well, you know
what?
I think
she just
she's
popped
here.
In, Glenn. She just popped in. Hang on.
All right.
Hang on.
Jennifer's going to see if she can get her on the line. Of course, Laura is the winner of the Mongol Derby this year. She is a teenager, 19 years old. She's niece of eventing legend Lucinda Green and has won the race this year. She is the first British rider to win, the first woman to win, and the youngest person to ever win the 1,000-kilometer challenge that began in 2009. We've covered this race many times here on the morning show. And it is quite extraordinary, the things that she has accomplished. She actually came in, she came in second place, but the lady who came in first place was eliminated because of some vet issues with the horse. So she ended up taking over the first place. So we'll see if Jennifer gets a good connection with her here and we can get her on. It'll be very exciting to chat with her. It's been a while. We've been trying to get a hold of her. She's been kind of busy. So we're going to find out why she did it and what the story is with Laura Pryor Palmer. Again, 19 years old, youngest one ever to win the race, first woman ever win the race, and the first British rider to ever win the ultimate in endurance races. And that's 1,000 kilometers. That's a long way. It takes many, many days, and they actually ride the Mongol ponies, which are provided to them. So they ride the horses that are given to them and they get different ones each day. So it's not like they get their choice. They don't really. Well, let's see. Laura's ready to talk to us. Good morning, Laura.
Good morning.
I'm so glad you got through. Thanks for being persistent.
That's fine.
We were so excited to speak with you. I was just telling everybody about all of the firsts that you have by winning this Mongol Derby this year. Is this something that's been a dream of yours to do, were you at a party one night and they all challenged you? What was the story?
I think I was at my own party on my own and I challenged myself, really. I actually checked up pretty late. I'd known about it for 2 years, I think, but it is really expensive. So I always thought, God, I won't ever be able to do that until I'm earning my own money. And then I signed up very late and I just thought I really want to do it. And so I got some money together. I still haven't paid them the full amount because you have to pay to compete. I didn't discover until after I signed up quite how tough it was going to be. You only realize that when you speak to past competitors who have done it, because the website is quite lighthearted. And even though they admit that it's a pretty dangerous event, they certainly don't tell you the full story.
Yeah, it's full of pretty pictures that make it look like a wonderful little jog through the countryside of Mongolia.
Indeed, indeed. Oh, God. You become blind to the landscape. You're in sort of, it's so beautiful, and you have to sort of hit yourself. Like, gosh, look at this. Because you're in so much pain, and you're so focused on where your pony's next going to step and how you're going to get to your next, to your horse station. You don't stop to look up and enjoy it, which is sad.
Now, were you an endurance rider before, or were you an eventer, or what were you doing?
I'm young, so I'm nothing. I'm just a schoolgirl. I event and I hunt, but I've never endurance ridden. So I thought I would never win because I knew that I suddenly discovered actually that endurance riding was a thing, and that there were going to be lots of endurance riders doing it. So I was really intimidated by them, and they all seemed to know lots of stuff about how to canter a pony for 40 kilometres. I knew nothing. So I learned a lot off of them at the start camp.
We do an endurance day here on the show once a month, and we have one of the top endurance riders in the world come on with us. And she talks about all the little intricacies like the tack and what you wear and, you know, how not to end up with blisters, and all of that stuff that goes into endurance riding. So it's fascinating to know that you really went into this without really knowing a lot about all that stuff, all the things that they plan and prepare for.
I knew absolutely nothing. But then again, it is not an endurance race. Like they emphasize that on the website. Obviously, it requires a lot of endurance, but it's very different to the sort of FEI endurance racing that everybody does. They take heart rates, but it's slightly different. Your time doesn't get stopped or anything. And it's like nothing applies in Mongolia. All your sort of preparation basically goes out the window, just so long as you're fit. That's all that's required, really.
You know, I don't, maybe this is because I'm a guy, but I think about these things. So when you're doing the race, obviously you're stopping in the evening, right? You're not riding straight through because this is a several-day race.
Exactly. They have a tracker on you. So you are not allowed to ride past 8:30 p.m. So you can't be moving past 8:30.
Okay, so are you eating? This is the thing that concerns me. Are you eating local food, and or do you bring your own so that you don't risk getting violently ill?
No, that was a huge problem this year. So you're only allowed 5 kilograms of luggage. So you definitely cannot take enough provisions to eat your way through the Mongol Derby, because it, you know, it takes 7 to 10 days. So you do eat the local food, but this year I think 90% of the riders got diarrhea and vomiting and, you know, sickness. Some got it earlier than others. I got it on the very last night. It's doesn't last that long, but it is, yeah, it's from the food or the water or something that they give you. And you're also, it's probably just because you're so dirty, your hands are disgusting, you've been riding a horse, you know, you don't have time to sanitize or wash, there's nowhere to wash. So you just, you know, you put some food in your mouth and you're using your really dirty hands. I'm sure it was from us. The food is fine. I got told it was inedible, but actually, you know, they feed you mutton soup and stuff, which is perfectly nice. There's just some bad stuff that they try and make you eat, like dried yogurt, which is the most bitter, disgusting thing ever. And then they also have this drink that they're all obsessed with, which is cool. It's fermented mare's milk. So they milk the mares there and drink, and then they turn it into alcohol. And they offer it to you, you know, in the very beginning of the morning. And then I think they drink it all day long. And it is just, you know, you can barely have a sip, and you have to try and look polite because they've been so kind to offer it to you. But it's not very edible.
So we're going to move from the digestive system taking a beating, and all of the pictures I see of you while on your clever Mongolian tiny pony, which looks to be about 13 hands, you're carrying a backpack. What do you carry in said backpack, and why?
So sleeping bag, because you know you get stuck out at night, so you need a sleeping bag. Carry a jacket, because the weather in Mongolia is extraordinary. It changes really, really quickly. So it'll be really hot, your pony will be puffing and tired, and you'll ride towards a mountain, and that will cause the weather to change, and there'll be huge clouds, and before you know it, it's raining seriously hard, and you're soaked to the skin. So a jacket, you know, some weird, you know, little instruments in case of emergencies, like ropes and a you know, tiny bit of food. I took a diary. I didn't write in it. I was too tired every night. you know, it was up to you. Whatever you could take, whatever you want. The main contents of the backpack, sorry, I should have said this at the beginning, was the bladder that you fill up with water and drink from.
Yeah.
Mine started leaking halfway through, which was a bit of a nightmare. I could only fill it halfway. So I would sort of, by the halfway through a leg, I'd run out of water and be really thirsty. So I hated it when it was hot. Much preferred it when it rained. We rode 25 different ponies, so I wasn't just on one pony, just to go back to that.
That was my next question. So you rode 25 different ones?
Yeah, so you obviously can't, well, you could ride one pony for 1,000 kilometres, but it would take you a long time because you couldn't be cantering all the time. So you ride each pony for 40 kilometres, and then you get to a horse station, which the organisers have got together. They've got a lot of different herders to bring their ponies along. And there are ponies everywhere in Mongolia. You'll be riding along, there'll just be these beautiful herds of, you know, mares and foals cantering past you. It is extraordinary. It's like a sort of, you know, horse lovers fantasy world. So they all bring their ponies along, and you know, it's just like a status symbol to have loads and loads of really fast ponies. And so then you if you get there early, you are allowed to choose from 30 or 40, you know, dozy looking animals, but actually, once you start tacking them up, they are really feisty and nothing like as tame as Western horses. So they're quite exciting.
Now, are they all broke or green broke or broke to death or what?
They've been broken. They're between the ages of 5 and 15, I think. Okay. And so generally, the ones. Well, they'd all been broken, and like they'd had a saddle on them, but like some of them just like refused to be broken properly, like the wildest ones. But then they always tended to be the best ones, the ones that wanted to gallop the most. So you had to sort of make a compromise and ask for the wild ones that buck loads when you tack them up and get on, because once you've got over that bit, actually they gallop super fast. I'm lucky I've got long legs, so the sort of bucking is not very comfortable, and they can get you off. I mean, they're pretty good at it, but you know, if you just sort of send them off in a straight line, they tend to forget about the bucking and just go. They're really
now you
They're so much fun.
You were talking about getting you off. Didn't you take a nasty spill the one day?
Yeah, I took two falls, and they're both because of marmot holes. I think that's why a lot of people fall off. There's these little squirrel animals that make huge holes in the ground, and sometimes there's so many in the ground that when a horse is bolting, it can't read the ground quickly enough to avoid them all. And my worst fall was on the last day. My horse went so far down into a marmot hole. I'm surprised it didn't break its leg. Rotationally fell over me. Landed on top of me. We rolled out. God, I don't know. I somehow managed to keep hold of its reins, or else it would have been gone into the distance and I would have come last or something. And remarkably, I was so lucky to be okay, and the horse was fine too. So it took me a while to get back on that one because it had been really wild. I put my foot in the stirrup to get on when the herder held it for me back at the station, and it managed to throw me to the ground before I'd even got on it. So getting back on it on my own without a herder to hold it was pretty difficult, but I sort of somehow got there, just kept trying.
Now, I assume you didn't buy that one and ship it home.
Oh, my God, I wouldn't have minded, you know. The ones that were feisty were pretty, you know, you had a lot of respect for them. I had the most incredible one halfway through. It was just like a lion, and I got on it, and I couldn't stop it cantering almost the entire way. It went up a hill pass in trot, which most horses probably didn't walk. It must have had the record for that leg. Like so fast, so fit, came into the station with a normal 64 heart rate, and it was just unbelievable and so wild. I mean, the herder had to ride out with me on it just to sort of stop it going nuts and stop it from really galloping too fast, and they had to get on it before I got on it to sort of, you know, get the buck out of it. So yeah, they're pretty exciting. They're not, you know, they're fun.
Now, how much of this would you say, and I'm not taking anything away from your accomplishment because it's absolutely amazing, how much of it is the rider, how much of it is the luck in the ponies that you draw, or how much of it is just crazy determination?
Absolutely, like luck, full stop, not necessarily from the ponies, but also just like luck that you don't get ill and have to stop and go on a drip. But yeah, but all the ponies, I'd say, yeah, if you're at the back, you do tend to, there's less, slightly less choice, but halfway through only half the riders were still riding, so that meant that there was no one at the very back, so there were always 30 or 40 horses at a station, so therefore they would only be choosing from the 10 to, you know, they'd still have 20 to choose from. So, and I got just, I think I got one hell of a lot of really lazy ponies, so everyone does get lazy ponies. I just, maybe I got less than others. Everyone gets fast ponies too. But I was extremely lucky with some of my ponies. I was just also really lucky with, you know, the navigation. I was used to that. I just followed other people. And then this year's course was slightly easier to navigate than other years. So that was lucky. It just depended, you know. If you were willing to ride on your own, that helped, because some people refuse to leave other company. And that just doesn't work, because you'll get on a pony that's faster than your companion's pony and you need to leave it behind, or it needs to leave you behind. But yeah, there was one hell of a lot of luck involved. It's, you know, it's nothing like training. You know, because also I didn't put enough preparation in to warrant, you know, me saying that I worked really hard for this victory, because I signed up 6 weeks before, even though I had been riding a lot beforehand. So yeah, someone else would have to analyze it, but I'd say large amount of luck. Large amount of determination, okay, too. But everyone who finished had a lot of determination. Like, it was just, finishing is more impressive than winning, really. It's just, winning is just a random bonus. I didn't quite know how it happened.
So now that you've won the Mongol Derby, do you ever want to do the Mongol Derby again?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, but I've got 10 pence left in my bank account, so I don't think I can. Do you know, I love it if the Mongol Derby was 100,000 kilometres instead of 1,000 kilometres, because you just as got to day 7, I was, you know, my body had adjusted to sitting on a horse or standing up in stirrups all day, and I wanted it to go on forever. I was quite sad it was over, so it'd be fun to do something much longer, or perhaps on my own, because I quite enjoyed riding on my own.
So we're going to see Laura Pryor Palmer, yeah, on Kickstarter. Yeah.
Riding across Europe.
Yeah, there's too many motorways in Europe. I'd have to choose another continent.
Well, congratulations. What a wonderful feat. And we're so excited to have the opportunity to have talked to you. It's going to make eventing look boring now. You realize that?
It has. I know. Sadly, my event is lame, so I'm not really riding my match at the moment anyway. But, yeah, so it's just eventing is like nothing like as thrilling because the horses don't gallop cross-country. That's why I've been looking at national hunt racing and thinking that galloping properly into steeplechase jumps looks much more fun than eventing and slowing a horse into a perfect, you know, bouncy canter for the next skinny. Boring and mathematical. Do you know what I mean? It's too girly. People think cross country looks tough, but actually, to be a jockey, I think is much braver.
That's funny. Your aunt just rolled over, or just went, what?
Sorry, did I talk too much? I've been in my room all day, and I haven't talked all day.
No, I think that's terrific. And it is true. When you're young and you do some of this daredevil stuff, you get done with it, and it's like, well, now what? You know?
I know, it's terrible. I think I peaked too soon.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I think, I think jump racing, that would certainly give you a thrill. That's gonna be every bit as challenging. So,
I'm too cool. My legs are too long.
Well, we'll look for you next year at the Mongol Derby, and you can be the first. Now you're the only. You're the youngest. You're the first British rider, and you're the first woman. Next year, you can be the first one to repeat win.
God knows, never happened 2 years in a row. That would be a real treat.
Thank you, Laura. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Bye bye. Well, there's an amazing feat by an amazing girl. Now it's like eventing's boring. Cross country's like,
what's the point?
And she left out one of the ingredients. There's luck and there's determination. She left out attitude. I think in order to complete the race and or win the race, you have to have the attitude. You have to be able to go, you know, my 675-pound pony just flipped over and landed on me, and by golly, I'm going to laugh it off and go gallop another 40 kilometers.
Oh, and I just got flaming diarrhea for 2 days, and you just like, oh, my God. All those things they don't show on the website.
That's amazing. Just amazing.
I know. And apparently she became friends in the article I read. I wanted to bring this up with her. She became friends and was not familiar with monkey butt powder. So she apparently became friends with monkey butt along the way.
Yes.
So you would have to, I would think. That's a lot of cantering. And can you imagine how your muscles must feel after day two? Probably after about day three, you're starting to work into it and you pass the wall that everybody talks about. And then you just become, as she says, you become numb. So it's
well, here's another key, because we could have probably talked to Laura for the next hour and a half. There's an article on The Adventurist, which is where you find most of the information about the Mongol Derby, that she wrote some advice. Up your drinking tolerance. The Mongolians like to offer alcohol as a kind gesture, especially fermented mare's milk, which takes gutsy digestion. So apparently maybe that really helps the whole achy body part. You have a little bit of that.
Sure, you're just drunk the whole time.
Yeah.
That would help. I'm not sure if it helps the achy body part or you just don't care. It's one or the other.
It's the don't care part that's important.
And these are little ponies. She must be a pretty tall girl because you see her in the pictures and she looks like, you know, her legs are coming way past the belly with some of these ponies.
Yeah, they look like in that 13-hand range, yeah.
But it's so funny because you see her in a lot of the pictures they took while over there, and she has this huge smile in every one of them.
There you go. Know, that attitude.
In the middle of nowhere in Mongolia. But what a fun guest. We'll have to get her back again sometime. I'm glad you stuck with it and were able to get her on. Appreciate that. Well, let's talk a little bit. There were a couple things while we're going on here today. You found, speaking of trails, we all watch the old Western movies and everything, and they're always doing these cattle drives that go for, like, you know, hundreds of states and 1,000 miles. And
they
have
go
these
for 90
cowboys.
Minutes. Yeah, the entire movie, 90 minutes.
You have these cowboys and everything, and you found something that was very interesting. It was about the different jobs on a cattle drive. Tell us about that and how much they got paid back then. This is in the 1800s, right?
Right, and I don't remember how I came across this anymore, but jobs along the trail drive. Apparently, different persons aboard horses have very specific roles when zhuzhing cattle across the open plains. And if we start at the bottom of the food chain, we have the chuck wagon cook, which I thought you might find interesting. And the chuck wagon cook is considered a very experienced person who was previously a cowboy. And they fell off and broke their leg and have a limp, so now they have to drive the chuck wagon.
That's just on my bucket list. I've always wanted to do the chuck wagon on a drive like that. I've always wanted to do that.
And you're perfectly suited because the chuck wagon driver, who is also the cook, awakens at 3 a.m. and has breakfast ready when everybody else gets up.
And it's my kind of hours, too. I'd be perfect at this.
Yeah.
How much does a chuck wagon cook make?
A chuck wagon cook makes about $60 a month.
It's an $18.90. Yeah, okay.
It's $18.90. And in today's dollars, that's going to be around $1,800 to $2,000 a month.
Well, that's not too bad. I could be a chuck wagon cook out in the plains, not have to worry about anything, sleeping under the stars with the rattlesnakes. By the way, they have in your description you found a little bit about what the chuck wagon cook made. So for breakfast, they had sourdough biscuits, white gravy, sow belly, which is salt pork, and black coffee. For dinner, they had sow belly. Apparently, they carried a lot of salt pork, black coffee, sourdough biscuits, and white gravy, and pickles. So they had the same thing for breakfast as lunch. And then for supper, guess what they had? Sow belly, white gravy, and sourdough biscuits. There wasn't a big variety on the chuck wagon.
Yeah, salt pork and biscuits and coffee. Talk about diuretic diets. They were perpetually dehydrated.
Yes, or had high blood pressure and their veins were clotting at a rapid rate.
Goodness. Wow. So
what were some of the others?
They have something called a horse wrangler, who is the entry-level position. Those were the greenhorns. And they zhuzh the horses around because they didn't ride the same horses every day. They had a little herd of semi-feral horses. From what I've heard from people who actually did this back in the late or the early 1900s when they still drove cattle that way, the horses weren't really broke. They were a little bit like those Mongol ponies. And the horse wrangler was in charge of keeping after the Mongol ponies, and he made about $25 a month, which comes out to $8,000 a year. Yeah, that's minimum wage.
Not very much. So that was sort of the apprentice job. That's how you apprentice.
Yes. Willing to learn and work hard, so he was a slave. He took care of the horses. The drag rider, which again,
hey, by the way, that's still the same in today. If you're a horse wrangler in a barn today, you're in the entry level position. That's about what you make, about $8,000 a year. So nothing's changed since 1890.
The drag rider, who was the person in charge of walking along at the back of the herd of cattle and making sure nobody fell behind, and he probably was in charge of taking note of the ones that dropped dead along the way, I would suspect. Yeah, and that's the dirtiest section because, you know, we had a couple of hundred cows or more strolling along in the dry, dusty sand, kicking up dirt, and he was riding at the back of it. Yeah, so he had the one with the bandana over his face.
How much did he make?
And he made about $35 a month in 1890s dollars, which comes out to about, in 2012 dollars, about $11,000 a year.
Wow, he didn't make much more than the apprentice.
Nope.
All right.
Next up, we have the flank, which is the guy who walks along the edges, and he pushes the cattle off that have wandered off into the hills somewhere, and he shoves them back in where they belong. And kind of like your pony does. When he wanders off where he doesn't belong, the flank rider comes over and says, oh, back in.
Well, you know, that was the job. That was Billy Crystal's job in City Slickers.
Yes.
Yes.
So apparently he's in charge of birthing calves as well then.
And I bet you that the flank riders didn't make as much as Billy Crystal did in Titty Slickers.
A few more zeros for Billy Crystal.
Yeah, yeah. So he made about the same as the drag rider then. They both made about the same.
Similar pay grade, but more responsibility. Yeah, that's one of those kind of jobs. And so, apparently the swing guy seems to have done about the same thing.
And then there was a point man. Was he the guy out front?
He's the guy out front. Works in groups of two and points the lead steers in the right direction. So he's the guy in the front making sure they don't stampede, perhaps.
Well, that would, yeah, and, you know, he also was the guy that made sure they were riding across lands that they were supposed to be riding across. So I guess he had to know the way.
Yeah, he had to know the way. He's the one with the GPS
otherwise,
in the front. There we go.
He got them all shocked by Indians or wayward ranchers that didn't want them on their property.
There we go.
So.
And again,
and then,
more responsibility, same pay grade.
Yeah, they still made the same amount of money, even though. But apparently, that was where everybody wanted to be. You wanted to work your way up to the front because you didn't get as dirty either, I imagine. You weren't sucking dust all day. So, how about the highest level was the trail boss, right?
Trail boss. He was the guy in the front. He's in charge for the entire operation. He is the what do they call it on a construction crew when the guy that's in charge of it all that really doesn't do anything?
The white hat.
The white hat. Yeah, so that's where you try to
go. He was Jack Palance's character. He was Jack Palance. Yeah, yeah.
He's in charge of push-ups.
Yep.
Yeah. And he took home a whopping $90 a month in 1890s dollars, which in 2012 dollars, get this, the guy in charge, $28K a year.
Wow. Wow, and he's the one that also, I think, handled the money and the transactions and everything when the cows got paid and all of that. He was the one that the owners trusted to collect the money. Interesting. Very interesting, Jennifer. I don't know where you found that, but that was really cool. I got one for you. This is 10 cool jobs today in what they pay. So this was
out
by Monster.com, and it was interesting, though, it kind of ties in with yours, because the first thing on their list of 10 cool jobs and what they pay, and I think you're going to be shocked. I was shocked when I went over this list at how little some of these jobs pay. Number one on the list was cowboy. So that's why I picked this out, because it kind of matched your list, and this is as a rancher or a farm manager, and you can expect to earn a whopping $30,000 a year average as the cowboy.
Wait a minute. That's what they made in 1890.
Yeah, pretty much hasn't changed. Now, they do say that you could get things like housing, a vehicle, and even beef or chicken as a bonus. So,
yeah,
you have to pluck your own and you have to kill your own beef. But beside that, it's great. And then you get all the salt pork and sow belly you want to eat. Do they still make salt pork? I guess bacon is what we call salt pork.
Bacon is salt pork.
That's our version of bacon, yeah.
We just call it something different.
I thought the second one was interesting. Actor or singer? There are about 50,000 Americans who work as actors, earning a median income of how much an hour do you think actors work? Now, this is all the actors put together, from the highest-end actors, from the Billy Crystals down to the ones who are working bit parts in movies and, you know, working as a waitress on the side.
So it's the median, which means it's half of them are above that and half of them are below it. That's not the average.
Yep. Yep.
So if I take numbers, it's going to be $7 an hour because the vast majority of actors make nothing.
Well, that's you're not too far off. $20 an hour. So they make about 40 grand a year as an actor, and that's the median income. And that's considering, you know, you got to figure that the high end of that is really skewed into the millions. So, you know, your top actors are really skewing those numbers. So you're right. It probably goes, for most, it comes down to about $7,000 a year. And it's a little higher with singers. They actually round out about $23 an hour. So it's a little bit higher with singers.
You're only working for 4 hours a week as a singer because you're getting one gig.
Right.
You make $100 a week.
Right, exactly. Now, this is one that's interesting that's on the list of cool jobs. is brewmaster. You know, it's every college guy's dream. Every college fraternity guy wants to be a brewmaster at a brewery. And, you know, with the microbreweries today, there's a lot of them out there becoming brewmasters. There's actually 4,000 members of the Institute of Brewing and Distillery. It's not going to pay a lot. So the typical brewmaster salary ranges from $25,000 at a local brew pub to more than $100,000 at a larger national brewery. We had the opportunity when we lived and had the acting company, which is Stroh's. Yeah, it was Stroh's that was in a huge brewery that they had in
Pennsylvania. Yeah. Reading, right?
Just outside of Reading, right.
Yeah.
And it was a huge brewery there, and we had the opportunity. They hired us to do a show, and we said, well, as part of the deal, you had to take us on a tour of the brewery. Well, the brewmaster at that time for Stroh's happened to be in the building, and he took us on a tour, and he took us like on a three-hour tour and explained everything to us. We got to see these huge tanks, and, you know, he would open the little spigot at the end of this tank that was a football field in length, and there's a little spigot at the end of each, and that's how they tasted it. So he would, like, open it up and have little cups, and we could all taste the different steps of the process of brewing Stroh's. And he took us up to the roof and showed us. I mean, it was an amazing tour of Stroh's Brewery. It was one of the coolest things. And so he was probably rounding out at about $100,000 a year as a national brewmaster. But if you're going to get into that, don't expect to make a lot of money in the beginning. Professional golfer. Now, here's where the numbers go up, actually, a little bit. The average yearly winnings on the Ladies Professional Golf Association were $230,000. So that is a little bit higher. With 161 ladies in the money list, top ranked, the Chinese girl named Na Yun Cho, is it, earned $1.8 million, while the 161st ranked earned $1,700. So the median salary of a professional golfer is $57,000, and you're traveling all the time. So you got to figure your expenses in there. You're probably not making much.
Yeah. Yeah, I always like it when they use the word median because mentally you always insert the word average, and they're really two entirely different things.
Right.
So means, 50% of the golfers out there are making $18,000 a year.
And for everybody that are Jennifer and I's age, maybe a little bit younger, you remember the Love Boat. What was the job everybody wanted on the Love Boat?
You could be the cruise director and party every day, all day.
Exactly. Well, cruise directors are the multitaskers of the sea. Of course, they're the ones that organize the shore excursions and the parties and do the, you know, bingo and all of that stuff. And they handle the guest speakers and the schedules and the entertainment, all of that. So that's what a cruise director does. That's a big job. I mean, it's a lot of responsibility. They truly are in charge of all the entertainment that's on the boat. And the average salary for a cruise director is only $45,000 to $50,000. And you got to think you're gone all the time. You don't have a life outside of the boat. So,
no.
Yeah. So that you don't make a ton. Now, probably you don't have a lot of expenses either. You know, your housing's paid for, your food is paid for. You don't have a lot of expenses, and you get the girls, I would assume. So just saying. Or the guys, if you're a female person. Personal trainer. Wow, that doesn't happen on boats, does it? Personal trainer. There are 235,000 personal trainers in the United States, and most of them don't sell DVDs at Walmart. So these are just the guys that work in the health club. And their average salary is lower than I thought it would be. It's $31,000 a year for a personal trainer.
Really?
But you're in shape. Yeah, but you're in shape.
Yeah? You look good doing it.
And get the girls. So that's another one of these jobs where you get the girls.
Well,
so we got the cruise director and the personal trainer getting the girls. Professional golfer maybe sometime. Brewmaster probably gets the girls because they just get them drunk. So cowboy probably doesn't get the girls. He's out all the time and never. He's always out.
It depends on which Western you're watching. If it's Clint Eastwood, it's a no. If it's John Wayne, it's a yes.
It's a yes, right. You're exactly right. Now, here's an interesting job that there's only two of in the world, and that's Academy Awards ballot counter.
I love
that. The guy who counts the ballots for the Academy Awards. There's two of them, and apparently they just hide them in a little room, and they sit there with a little piece of paper, and they count the ballots. And they're part of the, you know, everybody probably knows this name. They're part of the PricewaterhouseCoopers Entertainment division of that accounting firm. That's actually an accounting firm. And they've been doing it forever. So 72 years, Pricewaterhouse has been doing this. Pretty good bucks. If you want to be if you're one of the accounting partners who counts the ballots for the Academy Awards, you're averaging $450,000. So you're doing all right. My guess is you have to do something else all year long as part of the firm.
Here's the caveat there, Glenn. Your odds of getting that job are the same as the annual salary, $452,744 to 1 of getting that job.
And the other thing is you have to know how to count, so that leaves most horse people out of that. Broadcast, including me. Yeah. Broadcast sports reporter. Some interesting statistics here. And you know, you think a sports reporter on TV and blah, blah, blah. Well, there are 10,400 broadcast journalists for sports in the United States. 10,000 of them, which I was shocked at. And that's in broadcast. They average 54,000 a year. So you know that the Brian Gumbels and all those guys are making the big bucks. And then you have the local sports reporter on the local TV station in Padunk, Idaho, who's making $10 a year. So, you know, but there are 30,000 work as print journalists, and they earn a median salary of $34,000 a year. So you do get more if you're good looking and can be on TV. Mm-hmm. You do make more. But that's just sports. Okay. Firefighter. And this, they predict that this is a growing field, yeah, because we're having more fires, I guess. There are 336,000 jobs as firefighters, and this is professional paid jobs, not volunteers. So there are 336,000 of them in the United States, and the median salary is $45,000, and all I got to say is that ain't enough. It's just not – I don't care what they make, it's not enough. They say chiefs will make close to $90,000 a year if you're a chief, but, not enough. And then the last one, and this is another one where I thought it would be much higher, and they don't make enough, and that's flight attendants. Now, you know, it seems like a romantic job. I think it was a romantic job in the 60s and 50s and maybe early into the 70s, and it stopped being a romantic job recently. I don't think it's a romantic job anymore. Obviously, they get to see the world, sort of, but they start, get this, flight attendants. These smaller airlines start at $16,000 a year.
Wow.
To put up with the crap that flight attendants have to, the people flight attendants have to put up with. Now, the salary goes up as you stay on the job, and the median salary for the 90,000 U.S. flight attendants is $37,000 a year. So it's still not enough.
It's not a bunch. It's that would be tough to support a family on. Yeah.
I mean, when you see the kind of people that they have to put up with on flights, it's like,
yeah, like
I'm
me.
A kind of crap. Yeah, like you.
Yeah. I'm sensible when I fly.
Yes. That's the word. You have a little bit of claustrophobia going, so being in a plane is not your favorite place to be. So you have an excuse, though. You have a
Oh, that's it. I have an excuse.
So there you go. A little bit about jobs here on Horses in the Morning. And I think that's going to be it. I think we've covered about everything we had to cover today. And thank you so much, Jennifer, for booking a couple of great guests. Caton's always wonderful, and Laura Pryor-Promer, I love that one. That was a great interview, and we really appreciate her being diligent. Well, you know, she's diligent. She won the race. So
yes. She does have stick-to-itiveness, yes.
Yeah, she was going to get through on Skype if it killed her. Well,
yes.
Thanks to everybody who listened this morning. We really appreciate it. Don't forget, you can get the app for the Horse Radio Network. Just search Horse Radio Network in the App Store. And again, I checked the numbers again yesterday of the people who are downloading, and there's a ton of you guys downloading the app. Norway continues to be number 2 on the list of countries that are downloading our app every day. Although we had some new additions, Honduras was for the first time. A lot more Brazils and Frances are coming in, so we appreciate all
France,
of you listening
really?
from around the world.
All, things you say about France, and they're downloading anyway.
I know.
Thank you for being so kind and generous and forgiving.
Yes. You know, they're forgiving. Let's just say that. Yeah. And it is where the World Equestrian Games is going to be held next year, so they're probably more interested in horses now. So.
Yeah.
And also, you can listen to all of our past shows at horsesinthemorning.com. Blaze Kids Radio just put out episode number 3. You can find that at blazekidsradio.com or Horse Radio Network or on the app. So they had a cute show this week. If you haven't tuned in to Blaze Kids Radio yet, and I don't care if you're a kid or an adult, I learn something on Blaze Kids Radio every episode. I learned something about horses and what they eat this time that I didn't know before. And I've been doing, almost 3,000 shows here on the Horse Radio Network. I learn something new on this show every day. It is fun. It's interesting. It's got a lot of music. It's hosted by a 12-year-old kid. So take a listen to it at Blaze Kids Radio. Well, that's it for today. We'll be back tomorrow, Jennifer, with the EquityMFG.com Wheel of Trivia. And Jamie will be back tomorrow as well. Thanks a lot, Jennifer.
Your schedule. Call in between 9 a.m. and 9:30. 347-637-3238. Tomorrow, Wednesday, EquityMFG Wheel of Trivia.
Here's some new voices.